This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
We turn the corner now to a conversation that has existed at a very sort of rudimentary level here on Power Talk in the past, but one of which many theses in the development space have been written. And it's this issue of dictatorships versus democracies and which precedes the other in pursuance of a proper development agenda and growth for the economy. So, Germany, Italy, Japan, the former Soviet Union, even Great Britain under Thomas Cromwell were once upon a time dictatorships. They later evolved into functioning democracies. And in these cases, their development paths show that life improves significantly for citizens at the end of the authoritarian regimes. So in these countries, democracy was the game changer. That is the thing that shifted the needle. On the other hand, Singapore under the autocrat Lee Kuan Yew, China under the statesman and military commander Deng Xiaoping, Rwanda under its current president Paul Kagame, the sheikhs who've led the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Bahrain right now, to some extent even Libya under Muammar Gaddafi and Morocco currently under King Mohammed VI, they've all thrived in what are centrally controlled governments. The question we're asking is whether or not South Africa, given so many development challenges that are rearing their ugly heads in the country, including the fundamental issue of safety and security, does it require a stronger state, borderline dictatorship, and tougher hands, borderline controlled economy, to manage the complexity of the society and the multifaceted economy? Or do we just need to do the democracy better? Do we just need to do democracy with a social compact? We're joined by Professor Tumelo Senokwane, who's an independent political analyst and a lecturer at UNISA. Prof, good morning. Tumelo Senokwane, good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Lerato?
Fine, thank you. And we're also joined by Martin van Staden, Deputy Head of Policy Research at the Institute for Race Relations. Martin van Staden, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, you're going to need to come up a little bit louder for me to hear you better, Martin van Staden. But thank you very much for your time. Let's start with you, Tumelo Senokwane. Here's the thing. We're seeing a growing incidence of service delivery protests in South Africa. In fact, they've gone up 600% in the past decade. And it's creating a real mood of despair and frustration. And when people are frustrated about just being able to turn the lights on and there are no lights, or open the taps and there's water, or go to school and there are teachers, when people are feeling a deep sense of despair, they become nostalgic. And the nostalgia is for a former regime, which was a type of dictatorship. And they'll tell you that in the past, there was law and order. In the past, municipal services were provided. In the past, the infrastructure worked and it wasn't crumbling. Were things really better, working better in the past, whether we're talking apartheid South Africa or the Bantustans? Tumi Senokwane?
Lerato.
Ndati.
I think we need to move from a point of view that why do we have political systems? I think that should be the question, and maybe it will provide answers, because me and you will know that political institutions are there as organizations in a government that create force and to a certain extent or mostly apply law, and above that to make policy on the economy, social system, and to provide representation for the population. That's where I want to start, because you can, you know, talk about a lot of things, but if you do not understand the basic fundamental of why we've got political systems, you miss the point. And of course, people will complain, compare, contrast the past and the present. in a view that they prepare for the future. And of course, issues of, and I like the concept that you've just used of saying, you didn't just say democracy, you said functioning democracy. Mm. You qualify the concept, you qualify the view, because you indirectly acknowledge that there are deficiencies to the democracies that are there, that are before ourselves.
Mm.
And of course, democracy is not being, what you call very good for us,
mm.
or to a certain extent, and right for us, because we've seen its deficiencies, they've not worked for us. In mm. fact, we've realized that some of the things that happen are under dictatorship
yeah.
We're working for, in a better sense or in a larger sense, for the minorities there. And of course, mm. the majority will always say, yes, it could have worked better or perfect for the minority, but it worked for us in yeah. a certain, you know. So I'm just saying that as an example yes. to say, of course, contrast and comparison will happen.
Yeah. I'm just bringing also in the sentiment, not that I agree with it. And I want to stay with you, Dumi Sinokwane, just still on this issue. So for those people who are nostalgic, who are missing the fact that, you know, the apartheid government did things better. They often forget that this was a brutal system with zero tolerance for dissent and free speech. It was also a heavily militarized state. There were army caspers and soldiers patrolling the townships every single day, especially in the 1980s when there was a state of emergency. And we know that when the army is in charge, they obviously do run an efficient system because nobody is going to contradict a general. So if a general says, pick up a piece of paper, you're going to pick it up. If a general walks into ESCOM and says, make sure by the end of the business day, there is no stage 6 load shedding or else you go to jail or die, of course, things are going to happen. Are there any instances, Dumi Sinokwane, in the world where it is acceptable or justifiable for a military to be in government?
We have seen several states, you know, in let me, because I want to confine it to Africa for now, but we know that even in other parts of, in Southern America and other parts in Asia, where you will see that military government is in charge. Of course, even military government itself, you will see different categories, dependent on the profile of that particular constituency or the area itself, or the region itself. You will see different types of military ruling across. And we've seen, even in the recent years in Africa, there's been an overthrowing of government by several, mm-hmm. you know, military generals. And, you know, you've seen that people have been open to that to a certain extent. But the reasons might differ also. Reasons being that, you know, they say that an empty stomach does not have loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning that if a dictatorship is able to provide for its citizens, therefore, citizens will naturally embrace that dictatorship because it provides food to them, mm-hmm. it provides work to them, employment to them, and so on, education to them. But you can still be under a democracy, like a dysfunctional mm-hmm. democracy, where
okay.
you might not have food, where you might not have electricity. Therefore, it means nothing to the citizens
yeah.
of that town. That's why I started to say the question of the existence of a political system is very
right.
fundamental for me.
We will talk about, we'll do a small comparison in a moment. I want to bring Martin von Staden in here. So there's different kinds of government. There's dictatorship, where there's a dominant political force or party. There's an autocracy when it's literally a figurehead like a king or a strong man. And then there are totalitarian states, which could be either one of these two, but they want wholesale control of everything, the economy, the parliament, even how people conduct themselves in a social setting. Do you think South Africa's democracy is not working and ought to be replaced by any one of these?
Well, certainly not one of the mentioned institutions. I think the important distinction to be made here is that the opposite of dictatorship is not democracy, but constitutionalism. Mm. And South Africa has a constitutional democracy. And that means that our democracy has limits. It has constitutional safeguards built around it in the hopes that it works more fairly and more efficiently. But when you get to something like dictatorship and certainly totalitarianism, you cannot preload it with anything resembling a constitutional order, given the very nature that in a dictatorship the leader dictates. You have a small difference in a constitutional monarchy where the king is simply a figurehead. But when you have a substantive dictatorship, and I think, for instance, to Augusto Pinochet's Chile, where that military junta really did bring about economic growth and large-scale development, that could only really happen by, let's call it coincidence, call it luck, call it providence if you want to, because the people of Chile couldn't sit around a table and say, we're going to write a law or a compact, and this is how we want our dictator, our junta, to behave. That's impossible. It was only by sheer luck that that society ended up having a, call it a benevolent
Dictator.
dictatorship. And maybe you can say the same for Rwanda and maybe for Singapore. But the fact is, in most cases, you cannot preload your dictatorship in that way. Whereas in a democracy, you do have that ability to place certain limits on the power of government so that it does not become repressive. In a dictatorship, that's simply not possible. And I think certainly for South Africa, that should not even be on the agenda.
So something in the middle is, and perhaps this is what Ntate Senokwane meant when he said a sort of a functional democracy. It's not perfect, but it works. And it's somewhere in the middle, and it's a strong state within a constitutional order, but they have a very powerful hand on how the economy is managed. And this is now when we're talking about central planning and command economies, Martin van Straten. How do those work?
Yes, so that's a very important additional distinction, and that is between a dictatorship with a free market economy and a dictatorship with a central economy, a centrally planned economy. And in the latter category, you can think, for instance, of Cambodia during the Khmer Rouge. You can think of the Soviet Union. To an extent, you can think of China before Deng Xiaoping. These are instances where there is a centrally planned economy, and I think experience has shown us that central planning is what Friedrich Hayek called the pretense of knowledge. The central government simply cannot know what society requires economically. That's why you do need the price signals and free market forces. And then you distinguish that with Pinochet's Chile and to an extent Rwanda today, and Deng Xiaoping's China, where there were certainly far more wide-reaching liberalization of the economy, certainly not of social and civil liberties, but the economy, at least, was allowed to function. So in that sense, the state became weaker in economic in the economic affairs, which led to greater development and better social outcomes within the context of a dictatorship. So that is where you see the phenomenon of a beneficial of a benevolent dictatorship, and that is when dictators dictate a free market rather than a centrally planned market.
I really appreciate what you're saying, because it is a great segue into the issue of China, Ntate Tumi Senokwane. So nearly 40 years ago, China embarked on a very deliberate strategy to introduce elements of a liberal capitalist economy, as Martin is explaining, but a very deliberate, firm, strong socialist political system. And this happened under Deng Xiaoping. So, and it yielded results, because the fortunes of the People's Republic of China have changed dramatically. So a strong state politically, in terms of what are your rights as an individual, but a looser hand economically to allow entrepreneurship. Just tell us a little bit about how China got this right, if right is the word to use. Tumi
Yes, Senokwane?
Yes, sir, go ahead.
Yes. If one has to, what China did.
Okay, we're really struggling to hear you. Perhaps, Martin, you can help us with this one, because you touched on it.
Yes, I would say, as you qualified at the end, I wouldn't say this is China getting it right, but it's certainly China getting the economy right. The assumption was, amongst many Western observers, that because China liberalized economically, it would naturally also liberalize socially and politically, and that hasn't really happened. And I would say, unfortunately, because there are fruits from a socially liberal society as well, but China has certainly benefited from the economic liberalizations, especially when it comes to the so-called special economic zones, which are China's largest cities on its eastern seaboard, where there is virtually the freest markets in the world, and you don't see these indexed apart from mainland China. But that is a clear example where, without having to go to the electorate for a mandate to bring about these reforms, a quote-unquote dictatorship was able to bring about real economic development. So in that sense, a dictatorship is certainly more efficient, but at the same time, you really risk the type of repression that we saw with the Tiananmen Square massacre and so forth, where thousands of people can simply be killed at a whim for simply voicing a little bit of dissent from
And
the
very
party line.
briefly, Martin, I want to stay on this tack. Singapore under Lee Kuan Yew also had what you're describing, sort of a freeish liberal market, but very rigid politics. There even used to be stories that you can't walk down the street in Singapore chewing gum, you'll be fined, right? That's how pedantic they were and steadfast about cleanliness in the cities. But with time, Singapore kind of also loosened up, we're told, politically, not fully. So with time, as the society got more developed, they also stepped back a little bit on the political issues and there were reforms. Tell us a little bit about your views on Singapore.
Yes, I mean, that is absolutely true. Singapore back then and today ranks at the very top. It is number one in both the world's indices of economic freedom. So this is a capitalist economy where the government really steps back from that micromanaging economic affairs, and that has paid dividends for ordinary Singaporeans. Well, at the same time, as you say, their civil liberties are restricted, but it must be said that Singapore is based on a British Westminster form of democracy, so it can't be entirely said that they're outright a dictatorship. But it's true. We've seen this. I think it's more or less the same in Rwanda, where especially well in Singapore, to combat, let's say, the racial divisions that exist in that society, that government decided that it was going to have to put its foot down when it comes to social strife, and that it effectively outlawed, in many respects, racial discourse just to preserve social harmony. And that certainly is to a large extent an anti-democratic form of intervention. But that has produced the society that is hugely wealthy, while having this socially and politically interventionist state. But of course, South Africa has a democracy that it fought for, and we should look rather to, sure, we can learn from China and from Singapore and see how, within a democratic context, we can translate their economic successes, which is where most of the dissatisfaction in South Africa comes from, is economic, how we can translate that into a vibrant, open, and democratic society such as that what we want in South
And
Africa.
I'll raise an example that I think might fit the bill in just a moment.
9 a.m. to noon. This is Power Talk on Power 98.7.
We are talking about dictatorships versus democracies and which delivers development better. And we've also been told that sometimes you start with a rigid political system that loosens up the economy and with time starts to loosen up the heavy hand of government in the political and social front, ushering in a democracy. And we've been talking about examples from China to Singapore, and Singapore obviously having been a huge inspiration for the story of Rwanda. Ndate Tumisinokwane, I know you're back with us. Let me just say hello to you and just make sure your line is good.
Yes, I'm
Okay,
back, Lerato.
perfect. And Martin von Staden from the Institute of Race Relations, thank you for staying with us. So we won't go into the example of Rwanda or even the Gulf States, because I think it reiterates the point of the government controlling certain aspects of the market incrementally. But here is a democracy that is, you know, it's not perfect. and it hasn't always gotten it right. But in the 75 years or so, it has started to yield incredible results. India, it's been a democracy for almost 80 years. It's had moments of ebbs and flows. There was a time when India was one of the poorest nations in the world, being a democracy, but it has risen in its democratic edifice to become the number 5 largest economy in the world, and all of that happening in a chaotic democracy. What do you have to say to that, Dumi Sinokwan?
It depends on the policies adopted by that particular regime, irrespective whether it is under a dictatorship or a democracy. What then happens is that as soon as policies are identified, crafted, and approved by the system, as long as they work for its own citizens, then that's what we expect out of any system. Unlike having what, you know, people want to talk as beautification of democracy, yet it does not work for you as citizens. In fact, citizens can opt for a dictatorship, because at the end of the day, democracy itself want to move from the premise that it is the majority of people or the citizens have a voice. That voice can be otherwise, and we cannot want to behave as if one voice matters in our definitions.
Right.
Citizens can decide to say, under this period, we want this regime to be dictatorial, and therefore there's nothing wrong because it depends on the voice and of the majority.
Okay, so what would you say South Africa needs to do to get out of this current economic and social rut?
Look, we cannot take away the responsibility of citizens. Citizens are the ones who have been voting and have voted for a particular political party for them to rule. And we cannot take that away from anyone. And if the system or whatever the promises that were provided by particular political parties are not working, citizens equally must take accountability.
Right. Okay. Martin, let's get a final comment from you, just as a way of responding to what Dumi Sinokwan is saying, but also going back to the example I referred to of India, because I wonder, can people live in a world where they enjoy liberties and then accept a world where those liberties are restrained just because they need the economy to perform better?
No, so I would say that's certainly not an exchange that the people must make. I think India is a good example of a society that values its democracy and that stuck with it through thick and thin. But it had additional constitutional safeguards in such a big society, chiefly federalism, which allowed individual parts of India to pursue their own conception of how to get out of economic malaise. So we must be careful with the idea of opting for dictatorship, because in many cases it's something you can only opt into and shoot your way out of. So you can't vote a dictator out. That's democracy's real shining feature, and that is it's a peaceful way to remove non-performing governments from power. And South Africa should jealously guard that, but at the same time learn from Hong Kong, learn from Singapore, learn from Chile, and pursue these liberal economic policies of free markets, because that, if our concern is economic, will really solve the economic rut.
So please, just very briefly, what did India do? Because they struggled for a long time, for about 40 years of their democracy, and then there was a turning point. So what was that pivot for them?
My apologies. I'm not that familiar with the Indian experience.
And you know what? I love you for your honesty. Ntate Sinokwane, what would be a pivot? You know, where people say, okay, we've got the democracy, it's not working. These are the policies we want to see instituted to turn the situation around. We can no longer tolerate corruption. We can no longer tolerate poverty. We can no longer tolerate municipalities that don't work.
Look, the democracy itself has got different types. Maybe just to clarify that. You can go for direct democracy. You've got representative democracy. There's constitutional, there's monetary democracy. So it depends on what perhaps version of democracy we might opt for. But perhaps later, if we realize that it is not working, there are other systems that we might choose to, because these are not the only political systems that are available. If democracy, the segmentation of different types are not working, we might opt for a different, completely different. Okay. And Africa has had its own view on how things could be run.
I think this conversation deserves a 2.0, and I think both of you are best placed to take us into the next round of talking about different forms of democracy. I thank you so much for your interventions. They've been most useful. Martin van Staden, Deputy Head of Policy Research at the Institute of Race Relations, and you, Ndate Tumelo Senokwane, an independent political analyst and also a lecturer at UNISA. Just a little bit on democracy, development, dictatorships. And you can have a little bit of this and a little bit of that if it yields results.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.